station number 10923, Reel 9.
Mr. Harold Harper, Reel 9. What was the next thing that happened, really, after you'd formed this 520?
Well, we did a fair amount of training, although this was really to integrate the newcomers. But it soon became apparent that we would be moving back up to the desert very, very shortly. And having had something like 2 years' experience in the desert, we decided that the next time we went up there, we were going to be well-equipped food-wise. And so we all clubbed together, including the officer, and incidentally, we were going to be self-contained trucks. In other words, we looked after ourselves food from the food angle, cooking.
That was a change.
This was a change, yes. This, we knew we were going to... We'd been put with the 22nd Armoured Brigade, which meant we were going to be moving very, very fast. And therefore it was decided, particularly with OP cars. Incidentally, our OP vehicle was a Ford armoured car. And we went along to various shops in the Nafi in Cairo and literally stocked up to capacity with tin fruit, custard powder, milk powder, bottles of whiskey, tins of beer, bags of sugar, and the luxuries which we'd never experienced before. And then we set off up the desert, and because apparently the word had got round that Rommel was on the move again, having been pushed back to Benghazi earlier on, and that he was on the move again.
What was your little OP group? I mean, you've told me what an OP. There were three of you.
Yes, there was an officer who, in our case, was Captain Birkin.
Which one?
Captain Ivor Birkin. I was what they call the OP ACT, the OP officer's assistant, and we had two radio operators. One to the troop, one to the battery headquarters, and of course a driver.
And you were a little self-contained?
We were a self-contained unit.
Who would do the cooking?
We took it in turns.
Even the officer?
No. We all took it in turns.
And how would you get the rest of your rations issued? I mean, you told me...
They were always issued at night, after dusk, by a 3-ton vehicle coming round to each individual vehicle and giving them their rations.
And what about the cookhouse? What happened to that, the cooking personnel? They'd be no longer needed, would they?
They were put in what was known as the wagon lines, in other words, where what you call B echelon in the artillery. The people who were sort of following up, and they could, if necessary, still... And they were cooking for the people in the rear echelon.
What about
but certainly the forward troops were all self-contained.
What about the vehicles you actually had? Did you have a truck as well as the armoured car, the Ford car?
No, we had just had the Ford armoured car, nothing else.
Was it cramped in some?
Absolutely stacked to capacity with the loading of the truck was. A stroke of genius, quite frankly, because what with all our equipment and all the extra rations and goodness knows what else, there was hardly a square inch that wasn't occupied.
Yeah. Did that not make travelling very uncomfortable?
It was uncomfortable, but nevertheless, I accepted.
So you were moving...
In fact, we stood up most of the time while we were travelling. Yeah.
But you were moving up now?
That's right, yes. In stages. We probably took about 4 or 5 days. And en route, we were dropping into action. And on May the
Who against? I mean,
just dropping into action on imaginary targets.
Training.
And on May the 26th, I remember our officer turning to me and saying, "I do not know what else we can do to make this troop more efficient." Because by that time we'd reached a situation where we could be driving along and suddenly get the order, which there was a code name, and which I forget for the time being. And this code name was issued, and within 35 seconds we would have a round up the spout and in the air, having put the vehicle online.
Which troop were you actually in at 520?
D troop.
Oh, still Don troop.
Still Don troop, yeah. And I carry on from there.
Yes, you were moving up to the Knightsbridge box.
That's right, yes. Obviously, at this stage, we were not aware of what was in store. We were on this, what we call this exercise up the desert. On the evening of the May the 26th, Sergeant Major Earnshaw, who was the battery Sergeant Major, and myself went across to one of the B troop positions and sat in the back of a 1500-weight truck, and under the direction of Sergeant Bland, who was an expert bridge player, we were taught the elements of playing contract bridge by the help of hurricane lamp. When we left the truck, I should think just after midnight, and we wound our way back across the moonlit desert, probably some 400 or 500 yards, you could have heard a pin drop, quite frankly. Everything was so quiet. And we normally dutifully went to bed. I awoke early in the next morning because it was my turn to cook the breakfast. And I know one item of the breakfast was porridge, and I remember... Oh, prior to this, can I just go back? When I woke up that morning, I thought something must be in the air, because for the one and only time during the whole time I was in the desert, I had a snake in bed. And apparently this thing had been in bed with me, because it didn't move until I shook my blankets. And this snake was about 18 inches long and started rearing up, and fortunately, we all sort of had a spade handy for obvious uses, for digging up the stem. And to face a snake with just your vest on was quite an occasion. But nevertheless, I managed to hit the darn thing.
Were snakes common?
Not particularly common, no, but apparently the few that there were quite poisonous. So they told me. Anyway, whether that was an omen or not, I don't know. But anyway, I cooked the breakfast, had some rabid comments about the lumps in the porridge, and we just about finished breakfast when we saw this dust cloud on the horizon. Paid no attention whatsoever, assumed it was some of our troops on manoeuvres, and then along came...
Hang on, before we go on to the next thing, what did you know where your position was in relation to the rest of the box and to the unit you were attached to? Because you were attached to a tank unit, weren't you?
We were attached to the Royal Gloucester Hussars.
And did you know where everything was?
Pretty well, yes, at that stage.
Could you not tell that the smoke, the dust was in the wrong direction then?
Well, yes, except, of course, we, having said that, we weren't aware that some other elements of the brigade could have been on some sort of manoeuvre. I mean, this is what we were all... We all kicked dust up from when we went on manoeuvres.
So you'd had no briefing as to... As to
none whatsoever.
Possibility of a German attack?
No, we had no briefing at all.
Had you... Were you in defensive positions? I mean, what state of position was...
We weren't in a position at all. We were just sort of... the guns were just parked with the vehicles.
We
weren't actually in gun positions at all. No, we'd merely leaguered, as they call it, for the night, expecting to move the next morning.
So, you saw this dust cloud and ignored
and
it.
And the next thing, we along came the battery commander, and the last thing I remember him saying is, I think they are Germans. And the next instruction was for Don Troop OP to follow him, and the B Troop OP remained. So we went along with the battery commander, keeping a respectable distance of about 50 yards, and we paused just momentarily, having only gone about 600 or 700 yards, and the next moment we heard a gabbling version on the battery commander's radio, which immediately told us something was wrong, and Captain Birkin jumped out of the truck, dashed across, and we're talking to about 50 to 60 yards. I followed him, and when we reached the truck, it was, I've never seen quite anything like it in my life. Major Birkin lay flat on the floor, obviously dead. I went to the back and opened the two doors at the back of the armoured car, and apparently the armour-piercing shell had gone clean through the middle of the battery commander as he was standing up in the sort of opening, and gone and then chopped off the two heads of the two radio operators, and there was a third radio operator on the side who was the one who was gabbling the message. These heads were on the floor, and all you could see were the two lads were still, the hands were still holding their mouthpieces, although the heads had rolled onto the floor. A bit of a gory sight, obviously. The lad who was on the thing jumped out of the truck and ran across to our truck. My problem then...
So you actually went right across, because in the history it suggests that you were ordered back. That you know.
Well, no. Now, I went round again to the front of the truck, and my biggest problem then was to persuade Captain Birkin to leave his brother. There was a little bit more than just a couple of officers involved here. The brotherly love, so to speak, developed. And anyway, Captain Birkin ordered me, I said, come along, you must come back. He said, no, so you get back to the truck. He said, I'll see what I can do. And he ordered me back to our original armoured car. When I got back, I thought the answer is I must go and pick up Captain Birkin. So I put my hand on the driver, who would by that time had put all the shutters down, obviously, and was driving blind. And we'd practiced this for many, many weeks, whereby we applied a certain amount of pressure either on the left shoulder or the right shoulder. And according to the amount of pressure, the chappie turned the car, the armoured car. I suppose in the can I use the word excitement? It's not quite the word, but in the turmoil that was going on, I probably did made the wrong thing and put too much pressure on the lad's shoulder. And he turned just out of a cloud of smoke, out of a cloud of sand, came a Royal Gloucester Hussars Grant tank, and we hit it head on. And we literally bounced back, probably about 5 or 6 yards, and the next thing we saw, the engine was on fire. So we all had to jump out of there. In the meantime, we had accidentally run over the laddie who was the radio operator, who was the only one left in Major Birkin's crew. We'd run over his leg and broken his leg, so we had to drag him with us. And the four of us, plus this lad, dashed across, told Captain Birkin what had happened, and there we were stranded. And what we did, we jumped on. Hang on,
before we go into the next thing, the battery commander's vehicle had been hit by an armoured piece and shell. Yeah. Could you see where this had come from? Could you see where the Germans were?
Well, no, at that time it was the very first shell that was fired in the whole of the Knightsbridge campaign, because up till then we hadn't heard a noise of any description.
Did you have any idea where it had come from?
No, to be honest.
So
the only thing I do remember, and I've spoken to Captain Birkin since, who of course Captain Birkin is now dead, but the only thing I do remember is that he said, what had you in mind as regards range and for the tanks? And I said, well, I was going to fire at 4,000 yards. And he said, well, he got 4,500 in mind. So we were both pretty well of the same opinion, but we never got a chance to fire our guns.
But could you actually see these tanks?
Oh, yes, by then we could, yeah.
And when did you saw them straight away? Then?
No, in all fairness, we didn't see them straight away, because they...
I'm wondering at what stage you spotted the tanks, you see. Did you see them when Birkin's vehicle was first hit, or did you see them later?
Later. We didn't see them until after we'd sort of investigated Birkin's vehicle, quite frankly.
What about this tank that hit you? Where did that come from? The Royal.
Well, they were obviously coming. They were obviously realised that they got to come back, and they were to use the word, if you like, retreating. They realised they were being outnumbered, and they were coming back to reorganise.
So they had been in front of you.
They had been in front of us. Yeah. That's why we didn't recognise which were German tanks and which were ours. You see, but we then jumped on the back of a tank of the CLYs, in other words, County of London Yeomanry.
Was your the Ford, the engine? The engine had caught fire. That was useless now.
Useless, yeah.
What about the
front of the engine was all bashed in anyway.
What about Ivor Birkin, Captain Birkin? What state was he in?
He was obviously in a very distressed state to see his brother killed. But nevertheless, he maintained some propriety.
Was he functioning effectively as an officer?
Yes, he did. Anyway, we all jumped on the back of this tank and lay flat. The tank commander, who was a young officer, had no idea we were there and kept firing. And we just had to keep dodging as best we could when the barrel kept swinging round, when the turret was swinging round. We had to sort of swing, dive with it, so to speak. And one of our chappies fell off, and we literally thought he'd been crushed to death, but I was surprised to find out that he lived. Most of the chappies on the back received wounds of some description, although at the time we weren't aware of the extent of the wounds.
This is from the German tanks, was
this
it?
This was from the shelling of this. The battle was really sort of engaged by then, and one of the lads got badly wounded climbing onto the tank. He got a big chunk taken out of his backside.
Were you wounded at this stage?
I wasn't aware that I was wounded, but it turned out later I was.
Where had you been hit?
When we collided with the Grant tank, I was standing in the turret, and literally, I was crushed. Although the turret comprised a sort of a rubberized material, the impact broke my ribs right down this side.
The right hand side.
And later I found that I got some shrapnel in my left knee.
We weren't aware of this.
But I wasn't aware of that now, because there's too much happening. It was too many people were obviously seriously hurt. My sort of problems were negligible, really.
Did you manage at any point to get a radio message off to the battery? Or
no,
tell them what was happening?
No, we did not get a chance whatsoever. Everything happened so quickly.
Were you within visual range? Because she said it was only about 600 yards. Could they see what had happened to you, or had you gone over a hill or something?
I think we were over the other side of a hill, because obviously they couldn't see what happened to us now.
Travelling, was it difficult to keep hold of a tank in these circumstances when it's actually in battle?
I don't know quite how we managed it. It was how we didn't get thrown off is a miracle, quite.
Were there any sort of handholds?
No, you just sort of slithered around and hoped for the best and hung on to what you could. And then I can remember this thing firing within about 6 inches of my ear. it was quite an experience, really.
And there was no way of letting the tank commander know you were there?
No, we kept hammering away. Eventually, after a while, and what seemed like ages, and was probably only about 5 or 6 minutes, but nevertheless seemed hours, he managed to sort of open the little flap and see what was happening. And he said he couldn't do much for us, but he took us to their wagon lines, and then left us and went back into action.
Could you see what he was firing at, or was that impossible?
No, we were just lying flat, hoping for the best.
So you didn't really know what was happening around you at all. No. He took you back to the wagon lines.
Yes, and they were just moving, and.
This was their wagon lines, not your wagon lines.
Not our wagon lines, no. And they were just moving, obviously, the soft-skinned vehicles, as we call them. You heard that expression, have you? And there's a little bit of argument went on, which was rather surprising. The sergeant major in charge of this truck, which was the only truck available to take us to hospital, he said because they were moving and didn't know quite where they were going, there was no way he could help us. But the driver defied his orders and said, come on, get in and I'll take you to the field dressing station, which was about, I would think, about 2 miles down this track, all bumpy and goodness knows what else.
By now, people had noticed their wounds, had they?
By then I'd already torn my shirt and dressed a big hole in Ivor Birkin, in Captain Birkin's leg, and applied a field dressing to it. When we got to this field dressing station, there was an ambulance there. And four people, there was four of us who were available to go on, who were available to go on this thing. Five of them got on, and I was just about to step on, and a chappy came into the field dressing station who'd had his foot blown off on a landmine. And so I said, as I was still the only one who could sort of stand up properly, I said, well, you go on this one, I'll come on the next. And, of course, this ambulance just went along and on the top of the escarpment and on its way to Tobruk Hospital, and it was just sort of going out of sight as the German tanks moved in. And so that was... I was in the bag, so to speak, in a field in an advanced dressing station.
How did they actually take you prisoner? Well, I mean, what happened when the Germans arrived?
They just walked in. They didn't really take us prisoner in any. They didn't sort of okay. One German sergeant came along and said, "Hands up," and took anything off us. He took my pistol. Had a look at.
Was this your automatic or your official one?
My official one. I took my pistol, had a look at my wallet with the money in, gave me the money back because he said they got plenty of it already printed for when they went into Cairo, and they had. it's quite, you know, the more one thinks about it, the more amusing it was, really. But the main concern was for the water cart. Obviously, the Germans were short of water. They wanted the water cart. That was going to be their prized possession, obviously. Obviously, the advanced dressing station badly needed the water. And so I was sort of given the task by the colonel in charge of the first aid dressing station to talk with these Germans in their own language and express the necessity for the thing and the fact that they were treating German wounded.
They were, were they?
That's right, oh yes.
Where did you just a sidetrack really, but where did you pick up your German?
When I was at school, high payment school, yeah. It was the only language I ever learned.
And were you, how good at it were you?
I really enjoyed German, and so much so that if you enjoy a language, you pursue it, really. And I think I knew enough to sort of carry on a conversation.
How did these negotiations go, then?
Very well. We found the German panzer troops were very, what you might say, generous in a way. In fact, one sergeant came along, one tank sergeant, and actually gave us bars of chocolate. Admittedly, it was the only food we did have for about 5 days, but because there was nothing much in the field dressing station being cut off, and obviously any food that was available was for the wounded people.
Had you been treating Germans before the Germans arrived, or?
No, during the battle, they were bringing German wounded in. In fact, they were asking where the doctor was, and I was doing the directing and pointing in the general direction.
So you when you were taken prisoner, you weren't moved out of this.
No, oh no, no. The station carried on, and the battle was so fluid, there was no question of... see, it's not easy for tanks to take prisoners. Infantry are the best people for that, obviously. And at that stage, there were no infantry within miles of the place. It was all tanks.
So, and the tanks were just dropping off wounded for you? The German tanks?
Mm-hmm.